Welcome to Writers' Voices again. Glad to have you back. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me today is a very special guest that I'm really excited to have, Joanne Harris. Joanne is the internationally renowned and award-winning author of more than 20 novels, plus novellas, cookbooks, scripts, short stories, libretti, lyrics, articles, and a self-help book for writers. Her books are published in 50 countries. She holds honorary doctorates from the University of Sheffield and Huddersfield, is an honorary fellow of St. Catherine's College, Cambridge, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Joanne was born in South Yorkshire, England, of a French mother and an English father, and lives with her husband in Yorkshire, and she's probably best known for her novel Chocolat that was made into a movie in 1999, I believe, or something like that. And
I think it was 2000.
2000,
yes.
Okay. And the book that we're talking about today is a prequel to Chocolat, and it's Vian. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Joanne.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Or do you prefer Joanne?
I'm fine with Joanne. It's good.
Good. So I understand that you were a teacher and that you wrote your first three novels while you were teaching full time, and that one of them was Chocolat. Is that?
Yes, that's right. Absolutely.
Yes. And that novel must have changed your life.
Well, it certainly allowed me to give up teaching and write full time, which was, you know, not what I'd expected at all, because I'd been told that Chocolat wasn't the kind of thing that was commercial enough to sell. And so I wasn't really expecting it to be published at all. And when it was, and when it was so unexpectedly successful and went everywhere, I thought, at least, you know, now maybe I've got some options. And so I rather reluctantly gave up teaching and took a sabbatical. And over 25 years later, I'm still on it.
That's a love. Well, I don't know that it's exactly a sabbatical, because you've been very prolific during that time.
Well, I've written a lot of books, certainly.
Yes, yes. How many? Now, Vian, of course, is about the main character from Chocolat, and it's her earlier life. And or what's the timeline between this and that book?
It is set 6 years before Chocolat. So it is a Vian that we haven't met yet. It's a Vian before she becomes the Vian we get to know. Because, of course, I've written four other books about her. And I have taken her from being the mother of a young child to being the mother of an adolescent to being the mother of an older adolescent and a child with a certain number of neurological problems, and then later into middle age, the mother of two children who are leaving home, one who has left home already. So she and I have aged on more or less the same level at the same speed, and we've had the same adventures in motherhood. It's pretty much all we do have in common. But I think we both reached a point where, rather than moving on straight away, I thought maybe this is the time I look back and I examine who Vian is and answer a few of the questions about her origins that people have been asking throughout all this time.
Now, what are the titles of the other books about her that she features?
After Chocolat, there is The Lollipop Shoes. And then there is Peaches for Monsieur le Curé, which is called Peaches for Father Francis in the US. And then there is The Strawberry Thief.
Oh, interesting. So very fruity. So will this, do you think this will be the last time you write her story, or do you think you will continue?
I think it's unlikely that I'm going to leave her, she won't leave me alone either. I think it's almost certain that there will be another story about her, maybe about her past, maybe about her mother, who is an important character in all these books, but who we never meet. Maybe about her daughters, who have stories of their own that have barely been touched upon. I don't really know. I tend to take about 5 or 6 years to come up with another story in this series. And so I need to process what's going on. And I think I need a certain amount of life experience too, because I couldn't have written those books in sequence straight away. I had to give them time. I had to write other things in the meantime. I had to grow so that Vian could.
Do your readers ever like, hurry up, I want another one? Do you ever feel pressured?
No, I don't feel pressured, because I think my readers understand that I have a process. And that it's like cooking. You can't just take a cake out of the oven when it's still not cooked. You have to wait. So, but also I have a number of other ongoing series of books in very different styles, and they all have their own readers too.
So what are some of those?
Well, I have a series of books set in a boys' grammar school in the north of England, which is quite similar to the boys' grammar school I taught in for 15 years. I have a series of fantasy stories about Norse gods, and I write one-off standalones too. So I span a number of different areas of writing. And in some cases, I have readers who only follow that one area. And in others, I have readers who follow everything that I do because they're just curious at what I'm going to do next.
I would think so. So it's interesting. To me, you know, Chocolat really is about changing lives, right? I mean, isn't that Vian, you know, she wants to make people's lives better.
I think it is. It's about changing lives and about change generally, I think, and how it affects change and how responsible we are for the changes we can make in the world around us and to ourselves too.
What do you think was going on for you that made you want to write about, to write that? And to, you know, how, in other words, how did this character come to you?
Well, when I wrote Chocolat, I was the mother of a four-year-old. And so I wrote about a mother with a six-year-old so that I would at least have some of that experience. I was teaching in a boys' school. It was an extremely male, patriarchal environment. It was a school formed in the 16th century. I was one of three women members of staff. Everybody else were, they were mostly men of a certain age and teenage boys. And so, you know, I don't think it was accidental, although I may have not been aware of it at the time, that I ended up writing a story about a rebellious woman in a very patriarchal community, who sticks out because she is different, who effects change because she is different, but who also provokes a certain amount of hostility because she challenges the status quo.
Wow. How did your co-workers react to your success with that novel?
Well, as in all schools, I think all schools have a number of writers on the staff. Most of them were in the English department. I was in the languages department. And I think it took them all rather by surprise because I didn't really talk about my work until suddenly I couldn't not talk about it. And so almost overnight, 2,000 Leeds Grammar School boys realized not only that I had written a book, but that there may be little vignettes of people that they knew in there.
Oh.
There was one particular character, a physics master called Mr. Fry, who was a delightful, very modest man. And because I didn't think that a book like this would get any success, I used him as the template for one of the characters in the book and also his dog. And when 2,000 LGS boys realized that this had happened and that it was going to be a movie, I realized that if I'd really wanted to maintain anonymity here, I should probably have changed the name of the dog.
Okay. But
so there was great excitement.
But
you
liked this person, so I'm assuming that you gave him a favorable representation in the book.
I liked him enormously, and so did all the boys, in fact. And there was a great enthusiasm to know who was going to play Mr. Fry, who was going to play Charlie. And so when eventually the movie came out, because the movie came out just over a year after the book was a bestseller. So it was no time at all in terms of continuity.
That is like crazy fast.
Absolutely. It's super fast. I hadn't expected any of that. So I took him to the cinema to see the movie. And he went to the only cinema in Leeds that would allow him to bring the dog. And every time his character came on screen, I heard this anguished this sound, this terrible intake breath, and the dog would whine. And finally, we tottered out into the sunlight, and I said, "Well, Mr. Fry, what did you think?" And he looked up at me with eyes like stars and said, "Oh, Mrs. Harris, they've made me so tall."
Oh, how
so
lovely.
I think I got away with that one.
How lovely. Now, how about in Vian? Are there characters in there based on people you know?
Yes, but not in the way that they were in Chocolat. I think I'm more aware that people are likely to recognize themselves. And so there are glimpses of people I know in all my books.
Of but course.
There is very little actual portraiture in there. I mean, my mother is in there a little, and my grandmother is in there a little, as they have been in all of my books about these characters. I have always written about my own experience of motherhood, so my child is always in there, at least in part. Apart from that, generally, people would have a challenge recognizing who characters are based on, because I will take one little aspect of somebody and then another little aspect of somebody else, and there is no obvious single source for that.
So, as you mentioned, you've written many books about your experiences as a mother. Mm-hmm. And so your child must be grown at this point, if they were four at the 25 years ago. So how do they recognize themselves in
things that you write? I think there's always, when you're living so close to someone who fictionalizes their experience, you're able to filter things and to understand what's real and what isn't. I would think that most of the people wouldn't know, but it's all taken in great good humor.
Oh, that's good. And I imagine they're very proud of their mom.
Well, I hope so. It's always a bit difficult to tell when it's your kid, right?
Yes, it is. Because they may be proud, but they also can be critical. I have two grown children also. And so, yes,
I think it's very nice to have somebody who takes you back down to earth from time to time.
True. And they, there's no hesitation there. So did you always want to write novels, Joanne?
I always wanted to write, but I was born into a family of teachers. It was expected from a very early age that I would become a teacher. Nobody knew anything else. My parents were teachers. My grandfather was a teacher. All my parents' friends were teachers. So we were surrounded by this teaching environment. And so I think, nobody really asked me what I wanted to be. It was just assumed that I would make an excellent teacher and that that's what I would be. And so after having confessed at a very early age to my mother that I was quite interested in the idea of writing books, she looked at me in a horrified way and said, "Oh, that's not a proper job. You can't do that. People don't make money doing that."
Oh,
and then she took me to a wall of books in our house that was filled with novels by 19th century French writers who had all died penniless in the gutter of syphilis. And she said, no, you need something more solid than that. Being a teacher will be very good for you. And so I became a teacher, but I wrote my books anyway. And I never gave up the idea that I wanted to write. But I did think that it was very unlikely that I would ever make a living from it.
Well, you proved yourself wrong.
Absolutely, I'm very glad.
Yes.
I think, it was wise to have a plan B.
It is wise to have a plan B. And teaching is actually...
Eating for those 15 years might have been a bit of a challenge.
And teaching is, a good day job for writers in some ways. At least in the U.S. where you've got the long breaks, the summer break and so forth, that you can devote some time to writing if you want to.
I think so. And I think also it's one of those jobs that gives you a lot of contact with other people and on a day-to-day basis, unpredictable situations. So in terms of the kind of human element that I needed as part of my process, it was a useful source of inspiration. And you know, I've written three books about being a teacher, in spite of having said that I would never do this, simply because it's such an interesting kind of community, and it's such a stage for tragedy and farce.
Now, for me, it would be so exhausting to be in front of a classroom all day. I don't know that I'd have any energy to write when I got home.
I think you'd get used to it.
Really? I don't know that I could.
I think if you really want to do something, you tend to find your way how to do it.
Well, that is true. That is true. And what I do as a day job probably would be exhausting for somebody else. So it's just, I've had very limited experience in a classroom, but I did a couple of songwriting workshops once for a number of kids. I've done some other like speaking in a classroom, and I don't know. I really admire teachers for being able to do that all day, every day.
It's a high energy job, certainly.
Yeah,
it is exhausting. Yeah. When I eventually gave up teaching, I realized that, you know, I had been exhausted all the time for 15 years and hadn't quite realized it, because, you know, it's like when Wile E. Coyote runs off the edge of a cliff and he's still going all the way down. Well, it feels a little bit like that sometimes. But I also think that we tend to find our pace. And if there's something that we desperately want to do, then we make time, or we find time to do it. We give something else up if necessary to find time.
Right, right. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Joanne Harris, author of Vian. When you decided to write this book about her earlier life, how much of sort of the facts of her life did you already know from having referred to them in later books?
Oh, I didn't know very much at all, because she doesn't know very much at all. She only knows that she has traveled with her mother for her whole life until her mother dies. And really, she doesn't know anything much about her origins. She is, when we meet her at the beginning of Vian, she's 21. She's just scattered her mother's ashes in the Hudson River in New York and got on a plane to Marseille on the south coast of France, which is a city she doesn't know. And for the first time in her life, she is traveling alone, and she has choices to make. She's in the very early stages of a pregnancy that she didn't plan and that she doesn't quite understand. She doesn't know what kind of a mother she's going to be. She has very few skills of any kind, but she does have some intelligence and some maneuverability, and she's planning, hopefully, to find a place to settle down. This is where we meet her.
And she's, in a sense, undocumented.
Oh, very much so. She's been traveling under a number of assumed names. She doesn't really know what her real name is. She's never needed to know. And her mother has always made the decisions regarding what they are going to do next, where they are going to go. And they have never stayed in a place, any single place, for more than a few weeks at a time. So she's not used to any of these things that she's trying out for the first time in her life. She's not used to having a job, having roots, making friends, understanding the people around her, because she's always been warned off doing those things because they're dangerous.
So the things that happened to her in Marseille, or the people that she meets, were they surprises to you as you wrote?
To a certain degree, absolutely they were surprises. But I knew that I needed to find out where she had got her passion for chocolate, how she had learnt all these things, who she'd learnt them from, because she arrives in Marseille, she has never cooked a meal, she's never had a kitchen, she has never been in a position where she could run a household. She wants to do all those things, but she's going to have to learn from someone.
Absolutely, absolutely. So have you spent much time in Marseille?
Oh, I've been all over the place in France. Yes, I've been to Marseille. I know the southwest reasonably well. Not as well as I know Brittany, which is where most of my family are from. But I wanted it particularly to be Marseille because it is the second largest city in France, second only to Paris. It's a city of tremendous wealth and also extreme poverty. It's a city of migrants and tourists. And it is also dominated by this enormous symbol of motherhood, this golden statue of the Virgin Mary at the Basilica on top of the Butte in Montmartre. And because this is so much a book about motherhood and learning what it is to be a mother, I wanted that visual touchstone to remind me that this is what Vianne is trying to learn.
I'm going to be in Marseille in a few weeks. Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. I haven't ever been there before. I'm attending a wedding nearby in outside of Toulon.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And then so I'll be in that area for a few days, and then I'm going to take the train over to Nice for 5 days, and then up to Italy for a little bit. So it's really, it was fun for me.
Sounds like a fantastic trip.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. It was fun for me to be reading this at a time when I'm planning to go there. And it seems like almost everything that I have been reading and watching lately is set in the south of France. I've been listening on Audible to the Bruno Chief of Police books. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
So that's in the Dordogne region, so but not too far. And I've been watching Madame Blanc, which is set in the area around Nice. And just coincidentally, I didn't like choose those because of it. It's just they happened to all be there.
Well, it sounds like perfect synchronicity.
It does.
Although beware,
it?
Because the Marseille that I'm writing about is not the Marseille of right here and now. It is the Marseille of the late 80s, because, of course, we're going back into the past. And so it is the Marseille I remember from a certain period, and I know that cities change incredibly fast, although I get the feeling that the old quarter is still the old quarter very much as it was.
Well, I probably won't be in that area anyway, but why, you said you wanted to set it in Marseille because of all those reasons, and are all of the books about Vianne set in France, or does she end up making her way elsewhere at some point?
Oh, she does make her way elsewhere, but I don't cover that in the books that I've written, although I may at some point in the past. But no, they're all set in France. Chocolat is set in the south, the rural southwest. The Lollipop Shoes is set in Paris. Peaches for Monsieur le Curé is set back in the same village as Chocolat, and so is, for the most part, the Strawberry Thief.
And I believe I caught that there was a very brief introduction to one of the other characters in that is very much a part of Chocolat in this book. Is that true?
Yes, there is. Yes, there are just a few little waves to characters we will meet later.
Yep.
Including one who becomes quite important in Chocolat. But those are just little glimpses of what might happen. And there is a fair distance between Vianne and Chocolat, and a number of people have already asked me if I am going to revisit the Vianne preceding Chocolat again, so that we get another little stepping stone. I might do that. I don't know. I haven't decided yet. It really will depend on what kind of story suggests itself next.
Because I'm assuming she does end up going to the little village that she named herself after.
She does, yes.
She does, yes.
But not in this book.
Yeah, not in this book. So, but that's not the village that Chocolat is set in, correct?
Am I no, right it is.
It is? Oh, okay. I thought it was a different one. Okay.
No, nearly all of Vianne is set in Marseille.
Okay. Right, right. But I mean, I thought that there's a village. Is there an actual village named Vianne?
There is, yes. There's a village on the Baïse, which is called Vianne.
Yeah.
And yes, she may well end up there, but not in this book.
Right, right. Okay. So when you sit down to write a book like this, do you write from the beginning to the end, or do you have certain scenes in mind that you write and then you go back and fill in, or, you know, what is your writing process like?
It does differ depending on the book, Most of the time, I will write things sequentially from the beginning, moving on. I don't always know exactly what's going to happen next. Sometimes I have scenes that I know are going to be there, but I don't quite know when they're going to appear or what's going to link them. And generally, just the process of writing answers those questions for me. Some books are based on reversals and twists, and I do tend to go back and shape things differently when I edit. But most of the time, it's a fairly linear progression, even with the kind of flashbacks that I tend to have quite often in these books. It usually tends to write itself and to unravel at a reasonable pace, just if I start at the beginning and just keep going.
And do you write the whole way through before you really start the editing process, or do you edit as you go?
I do both. I edit as I go for myself. When I have a first draft, I will then re-edit the whole thing. But part of my process is reading aloud. And so generally when I begin the day, I will read aloud whatever I wrote the previous day. I will do a quick edit for line by line style and fluency while I'm doing that. And by that time, I am usually in the zone to keep writing. And so that is that sort of little generally polishing what I'm doing as I go is something which is an inevitable part of the process, which means that usually by the time I get to a first draft, it is reasonably polished on the line by line status. And anything that needs editing is usually structural or expansive, or in some way it will require a little bit more than just looking at the words.
And is that, at that point, are you working with an editor, or is that something you're still doing by yourself?
It depends. It depends what the time frame is. But usually, if I have time, I like to go through it once on my own, and then I will send a reasonably clean first draft to my editor to get their thoughts. And then I will do another edit for my editor, and that is usually it. That's usually as much as it needs.
I imagine that your books are sold before you write them, in a sense, you know, that the editor's expecting it from you.
Yes, there's usually a contract for X number of books. Usually they're aware of what I'm writing, although I may sometimes give them a sample of it, or sometimes I'll just say, okay, this one's a bit weird, I'd rather wait until I've got a finished draft and then you'll know what it is. And you won't be asking questions halfway through, because sometimes those questions don't get answered straight away.
So do you have deadlines and for each book?
Putatively, I have deadlines. They're quite fluid. I generally don't like deadlines very much because I don't think it helps me. But if I know that I'm up against a deadline and I am unlikely to reach it comfortably, I will warn my publisher and say, right, I need another 3 months on this. And they will shift things around. It's usually fine to do that as long as you don't do it at the last minute. And as long as you don't keep on doing it. And so I try and think things through. I mean, for instance, with Vianne, I was supposed to submit Vianne in spring. But my father had a fall and broke his hip and then became increasingly ill. And until he died that summer, I was basically running to and from hospitals and looking after him and my mother. And a lot of things got in the way of finishing the draft. And so I said, I need 6 more months to finish it, which is what I did. So I finished it in late summer. And that didn't actually affect the publication, the release of it at all.
Oh, wow.
It just meant that various key personnel who were waiting on things like copy edit just knew that they would get the work later and that it would have to be shuffled around with their schedule. But, you know, this happens all the time in publishing.
Of course. How long does it take you typically to write a book from start to when you submit it to your publishing house?
It depends what you mean by start.
Good question.
I have books that are ideas rattling around in my head for years, or a little stub of a book with a little idea which I haven't properly expanded on. I would think, as a rule, from me sitting down and writing the first page, it will take me between a year and 18 months. But because I don't always write one book at a time, very often I'm writing several things at a time, I have this tendency to write maybe 150 pages of something, then leave it for a while, work on something else, and then come back later and finish the book. And this can be either a year later or several years later, depending on exactly what it is and what my publisher knows about it. And so I've usually got several projects, and there is one kind of, if you like, a lead project, which my publishers know about. And then there are a number of side projects, which means, for instance, that if I have to stop and wait for something to percolate, or if I have to do some research, or if I'm really not sure where the story's going for a while, then I can move on to something else and then just go back when I'm sure of being able to continue with the main project. So it means that I will take generally between a year and maybe 7 years to finish a book, depending on what stage of cooking my work in progress happens to be.
Do you have a fixed writing schedule?
Not so much, no. I mean, I have preferred places and times, but because I do all sorts of other things other than writing, because I travel, I tour, I do journalism, I do other things that basically don't allow me to have a fixed writing day a lot of the time, I will use whatever time's available. I have a shed in my garden. I write there when I'm at home, and that tends to be one of my favorite places to write. But I don't always have the luxury of a writing routine that lasts for any length of time. And so I've got very good at using the time available, the space available. Hotel rooms are good. Airports are not too bad. You know, this kind of thing.
So do you ever write in coffee shops?
Sometimes I write in coffee shops if there isn't a lot of loud music. The one thing I don't like when I'm writing is music, because of the reading aloud and the being aware of the rhythms of the phrase, I find that music tends to be a bit intrusive.
That makes sense. I recently...
Although noise, ambient noise isn't a problem.
I recently learned the term she shed. So when you said you have a garden shed, I thought, oh, she has a she shed. You know, there's man caves and there's she sheds.
Yes, quite.
Okay, so why don't you read a little bit from Vian for us, Joanne?
Okay, sure. This is the UK edition, because I haven't seen the US edition yet. I'm very excited. They're arriving tomorrow.
Ah.
But I'm going to read just from the very beginning of Vian, which is written as a sort of diary, beginning in 1993 on the 22nd of July. I scattered my mother's ashes in New York on the night of the 4th of July. I remember the scent of the harbour and the warm wind over the sun-baked stone and the sweet nostalgic trace in the air of pretzels and doughboys and garbage and smoke and the hot, sharp, dangerous scent of fireworks from the booming sky. After that, I was done with New York. That had been her dream, not mine. I spent our last dollars on a cheap flight to Marseille and found myself 3 days later on a very different harbour front, looking out over the Mediterranean. The heat was the same, but there was a breeze and a scent of salt and ozone coming from the water. I had the clothes I stood in and a single canvas travel bag containing my papers, my wallet, a change of clothes, my mother's ring, and the little toiletries kit they hand out in economy class. A battered pocket-sized map book of France and my mother's tarot cards in their sandalwood box. I had barely 500 francs, no family and nowhere to go. The name on my passport said Sylviane Rochat. Time for a change of scenery. My mother and I have always kept largely to the cities. It's easier to disappear in a city, she used to say. Easier to be no one. Easier to pass unseen. I never asked her why she longed so much for oblivion. But cities are crowded, impersonal, filled with people passing through. Cities are pockets to be picked, cheap hotels left without paying the bill, cheap food, second-hand clothes, no one asking questions. A child alone in a city provokes no curiosity unless she is clearly in distress. And I was a resourceful child who knew where to go, how to find things, how to source free food in markets, how to trade work for necessities. But now, for the first time, I was truly alone. My mother was gone, and so were her fears. The fear of staying too long in one place, of putting down roots, of the shadow. Of the shadow, most of all, the man in black that pursued us. All gone now, all scattered into the breeze of the Hudson on that 4th of July. I was free. Except it didn't feel that way. Total freedom sometimes feels like a kind of paralysis. So many choices, so many doors, all clamoring to be opened. But with every choice we make, so many more must be put aside. Discarded futures, unknown friends, lives unlived and paths uncrossed. My mother had always been the one who had decided where to go. So many plans, and in the end, so little time to pursue them. And here was I, at 21, with nothing but choices ahead of me. I felt like something blown on the wind, disposable as litter. That wind. Oh yes, I can feel it now. It changes its name, as we always have. Tramontane, Santa Anna, Sirocco, Levant, Austria, Mistral. I can feel it pulling me, to Italy perhaps, or Spain, or along the coast to Montpellier, or inland to Toulouse or Armagnac. Which will it be, Vianne? Which will it be? Bordeaux or Montpellier or Nice, Rome or Venice or Milan, London, Oporto, Strasbourg, Berlin, but never a place we have been before, and never Paris, never there. I opened the map book at random. Sometimes she used to do that, just to see what synchronicities might emerge. Spread before me, the pages reveal a section of the River Baïse, with a handful of little bastides clinging to it like leaves on a vine. It is a part of France that I do not know well, but to which I have returned at last, as if almost by instinct. One of the bastides has a woman's name, Vianne. I like the sound of that. It's almost my name, but not quite. A name like a shoot growing out of a tree. A sign, perhaps, of things to come, a place of reinvention. It sounds like a good place to head for, at least until something better occurs. Yes, maybe I will head for Vianne and find myself along the way.
Thank you, Joanne. That was Joanne Harris reading from Vianne. You know, It made me very nervous when I was reading the parts where she had no one, nothing, didn't know where she was sleeping, had almost no money. Did it make you nervous to write those? Is that hard for you to put somebody in that position?
Oh, absolutely. Although I've always known that she could handle herself, I'm pretty sure I couldn't. It's one of the many things we don't have in common.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make it clear that she is a migrant, that she is an undesirable, that she is an outsider, that she is homeless, that she is different. Because we're living in times when people who are different are viewed with tremendous suspicion. And I wanted to create a character that we were going to root for and love and understand. And maybe by doing that, understand others in her position.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And it's so true. And I often think that fiction can be one of the best ways to convey a lesson, in a sense, to teach. It can be one of the best ways to teach.
I think we learn best through stories. I think we tend to be connected to people in stories, if we feel for them, if we follow their adventure, we tend to make an emotional connection with them that we don't necessarily make with everybody we meet in everyday life. And so stories are an entry point into other people's experience, other people's culture, other people's shared humanity. And I think the more we read of other people's stories, the more able we are to empathize with people in the real world and to understand that everyone has a story and to be interested in the stories that people have to tell.
And that's why it's so important that kids learn to read for fun, you know, so that they can get beyond whatever narrow worldview.
Absolutely. I think reading for fun is absolutely vital in terms of getting people interested, getting young people interested in each other, in the world, nurturing their independence, their empathy, their imagination. And I think it shouldn't stop in childhood either. I think many people feel that they have to put aside childish things and the pleasure of reading. They have to read for improvement or for all sorts of other reasons, which are equally valid. But it's quite important to keep hold of the pleasure and the joy of reading too, because it is one of life's immense joys.
Oh, absolutely. I was the kid, you know, who read with a flashlight under the covers at night.
Yes, so did I.
who had the textbook like this in the classroom with the book I was actually reading inside it.
Yes, that sounds like a very familiar scenario. I was exactly like this too. I know many, many people who were.
Yeah,
and who still are.
Yeah,
I'm all for it.
Now here's the thing. I had this vision and I became a mother very young, so it was as a teenager. I had this vision that I would have children at the park playing on the swings, and I'd be sitting there reading a book. Ha!
Yeah, I'm not sure that would work. But
that never happened. I thought, oh, you know, having little kids, you have lots of time to read. No, not so much. But
reading to children is a wonderful thing to do.
It is. It is.
It's a wonderful bonding experience for a parent. It gives the kid a head start at school. And it really helps to bring stories alive, especially when you have a child who's maybe a little bit of a slow reader initially, but who likes stories. I mean, my brother was a terribly slow reader, and he was 10 years younger than I was. But I read to him as a child, and I got him interested in reading. And I read to my own child too, right until, you know, the mid-teens, because I think it's a really fun thing to do for both parties.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I was also the aunt that read to the kids and so forth. And I always would make the voices, you know, it was.
Of course. The voices are essential.
Yes. It was so much fun. Now, in Vian, and I'm assuming in probably most of your books, there's a lot of wonderful descriptions of food.
Not in all my books,
not
but in the Vian books,
okay.
There's a lot of food, yes.
Okay.
Because food is often a metaphor for something else in these books.
Yes, yeah. So, and I understand you've written cookbooks as well?
I wrote cookbooks slightly under duress because I've written so many books that people wanted the recipes from that I thought, you know what, I'm going to write a cookbook and put the recipes in there and give the money to charity, and that way I will do a good thing and not feel that I'm selling out in some other way. And so, yes, I tend to point people to these recipe books I've written in the hope that, you know, if they are wanting to try these recipes, they'll be able to work them out.
So how did you learn to cook and develop recipes?
Oh, well, I'm not the same kind of cook as Vian is. I don't cook the way she does. And but I came from a family of women who liked to cook, and particularly my French side. And the kitchen was very much the center of things. And so if you wanted to know what was going on in the family, you sat around in the kitchen and you listened to people talking. And I was the kind of kid who was always there underfoot, shelling peas, listening to what the grown-ups had to say. And it struck me that this was a way that you got stories.
You know, my daughter, when she was little, she remembers being like around with my ex-husband's mother and his sisters and stuff. They were farmers. They were, you know, country people sitting around the table and talking and, you know, talking about things.
Absolutely.
That, and she would hide under the table to listen.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely, because food can be an incredibly social event, can't it? We come together as families, as friends, to share food. Yeah. And it is a cultural indicator too. You can find out a lot about people by the circumstances in which they eat, who they choose to eat with, how they choose to cook, whether food is nostalgic for them, whether it's stressful, whether they have positive or negative associations with it. It's an easy entry point to another culture, because you don't necessarily have to learn a language, but you can be positive and embrace a culture by embracing the culinary traditions of that culture. And of course, as you, my mother being French and living in England, it was the way she kept hold of her culture, as I suppose many Americans do, by cooking the food of her native land.
It's interesting how many more international foods have been accepted and kind of become part of the American foods culture in my lifetime. When I was a child, you know, you had, you know, there maybe were some Italian restaurants and Chinese, and that was about it. And you know, the Italian food had been pretty well kind of incorporated into the cuisine of all the cultures, but that was about the only one. We didn't really make Chinese food much at home.
Mm-hmm.
I never had tasted an avocado. never had tasted a lot of things. And now, almost even in a small town, the small town in Iowa where I live most of the time, you've got Thai, you've got Indian, you've got certainly Mexican, Chinese, Italian, Ethiopian, Turkish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's great, though.
Yeah,
it's a great thing to have, that diversity of choice, but also that reminder that we all have our different traditions and we all love them for different reasons and we want to share them with other people.
Now, how did you choose chocolate as sort of the focus for Vian?
Well, chocolate is so different to any other kind of food. It has so many potential sources of story. I mean, it has this very long history, this very interesting folklore. It's an ancient product which has come from, you know, the South American tradition, but has managed to find its way somehow into every country in the world since then and has gone through a number of changes, has been folkloric, has significance that way, has religious significance, has a tremendous amount of cultural and historic significance, is now incredibly vital to the economy of the world. It creates such a lot of money and work, and it's very political in many ways too, because we are always looking at where chocolate comes from and how we can try to achieve some sort of fairness in terms of the money that the West makes of chocolate and the money that the actual growers make of chocolate.
Yeah, there's a line in your book about that, in this book, about the farmer may never have tasted the actual result of their work.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been to chocolate farms in Africa where really the workers and the people who run the farms have never eaten chocolate as we would eat chocolate. And then I've been to places in Principe where a little island off the coast of Africa, where the people are reclaiming their tradition of chocolate making and have bean to bar processors where they can actually make chocolate on site and export it. And of course, the world has a tremendous appetite for artisan chocolate as well as mass produced chocolate. But it's fascinating. But there's always been a bit of a religious component in chocolate. You know, when it arrived, there was tremendous hostility to it initially because nobody quite knew what it was. People thought it was a poison. People were afraid of where it had come from. Then it started to get dangerously popular, which upset the church because the church was not quite sure whether it counted as food or not. When it determined that it wasn't actually food, because at that time chocolate could only be in liquid form, people started really to take advantage of this. And during the interminable masses and services in Lent, they would have the rich would have chocolate brought in for them by their servants, sometimes 10 or 12 times during a sermon. And so the Catholic Church objected to this. And so there's always been a bit of a sort of an anxiety around chocolate and whether it was a sin, whether somehow there was something profane about it. And particularly in Catholic countries, this idea of chocolate being a sin has entered the social consciousness. And so I wanted to write a book that was effectively about the dynamics of church and chocolate, fasting and feasting, against a background of Catholicism and paganism. And so I have Fiane and her chocolaterie, and I have Renaud and his church, and then I have the inhabitants of the village who find their ground around one or the other individual.
Wow. Did the church have the same issues with coffee?
No, not at all. No, coffee was accepted in a completely different way. But I think that although you would think they were quite similar, there was something about chocolate that made it different. I think partly because chocolate has never been used. Coffee has never been used ceremonially as chocolate was in that way, has not had its ritual significance. But also, I think people became very greedy for chocolate, and the stimulant effects of chocolate were very strong, stronger, in fact, I think, than coffee when it was consumed in the way in which they prepared it. And it got a bit of a reputation in the chocolate houses of Europe, and people started saying it was an aphrodisiac. And so that, too, made it dangerous and exciting in a way that I don't think coffee ever had. And coffee was accepted and was liked, but chocolate was... chocolate was unsafe.
I think hot chocolate is more popular in Europe than it is in America, in the United States, that we don't drink a lot of hot chocolate as adults.
Maybe not.
Yeah. But mocha, chocolate and coffee. Uh-huh. Now that's another story.
Well, of course, I think chocolate has been accepted by all sorts of different cultures, and people have made it their own. And so people have their own way of making it and of consuming it.
Yeah.
But certainly the triumph of the chocolate industry over festivals like Easter and Christmas has been phenomenal. The idea that, you know, Easter and chocolate is now pretty much synonymous. It is fascinating because originally there was no such association.
And of course, Valentine's Day.
Absolutely, this too.
Yes.
Important religious festivals now have a chocolate component, which I think is very funny.
So, Joanne, let's talk. I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of your other types of writing. You've written so many different things. Libretti?
Yes, I mean, I've written for the stage. I've collaborated with musicians. I co-wrote an opera which was performed just before, in fact, COVID broke, and so we had many plans to take it to a bigger stage, and that didn't happen. With Howard Goodall, the composer, I think Howard is now very busy and is not quite in a position to develop it anymore. So I'm trying to do it on my own with various local.
What's it about?
Theatres. It was about Pre-Raphaelite women, but the models for Pre-Raphaelite artists and their own stories, and how wonderfully diverse they were, and how their stories are seldom told, because generally these models are seen through the male gaze of the artists who painted them. And this was a piece that allowed them to speak in their own voices, which was lots of fun, actually. I really enjoyed doing that.
Now, it sounds like that's something that would have taken quite a lot of research. And you mentioned, you know, that sometimes you stop writing to do research. Do all of your books require some amount of research?
I think all books do to a certain degree, but I don't tend to do research in the way that a lot of authors do. I don't start with a topic, research it, and then write the book. I usually write books about things that have interested me for a long time. And because I fell in love with Pre-Raphaelite art when I was about 14. And so you might say that it has been the culmination of a lifetime's unofficial research, because I reached a point of knowledge at which I thought, oh, this would be fun to write something about it. And in fact, I wrote a book about the Pre-Raphaelite art world. It was my second novel. It was called Sleep, Pale Sister. And it was very much set in the world of the Victorian art scene.
I'd also like to ask you about your self-help book for writers.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called? And what's kind of the focus of that book?
It's called 10 Things About Writing, and it was based on, at the time I had a Twitter account in which I gave a lot of tips to emerging writers. And after a while, I got to get so many requests, and it took a few years for people to keep saying, oh, why don't you put all this in a book? Why don't you do that? And during COVID, when people generally had more time and they were locked down for long periods of time, and many people said, okay, this is when I start writing this book I've always wanted to write. Can you give me some tips? And so I started doing these YouTube tutorials. And I also released this book at the same time so that people would be able to have that information in one place. And so it's about how to analyze your writing to be better as a writer. But it also looks at all aspects of a writer's career. It's not just for people who want to be career writers, but it's also about being a writer and what that entails.
When you were still teaching, and you published three books during that time? How did you get your first book published?
Oh, with tremendous difficulty, because I had no idea how to do it, and we didn't have the internet in those days, so there was no supportive online community. I just had to make every mistake I could possibly make until finally I found my way in there. So I'd written this book called The Evil Seed, and I just sent it to every publisher I could think of with no result at all, because, you know, sending things to publishers generally doesn't work, and it didn't then either. I eventually then found myself an agent, and my agent sold the book. And after many false starts and disappointments, the book eventually came out and more or less sank without trace. And then I did it again. But yeah, it took a while. It took me about 2 years to find an agent. It took my agent about a year to find a publisher for the book. It took another year for the book to come out. So during that time, I was writing something else, something which was closer to my voice, because I think it took two books really for me to understand what my authorial voice was supposed to be. I was very good at pastiching other novelists, but I hadn't yet gained enough life experience, I suppose, to have a voice of my own. And with Chocolat, I think I found it.
Do you have a favorite among your books, or is that like asking if you have a favorite among your children?
Well, these things are basically snapshots from different times, and so I don't really play favorites in that way. Although there are books that I've found more difficult to write than others, and so I feel more of a sense of accomplishment for having written them. But no, favorites, I don't think I play that game.
Joanne, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and spending this time with us here at Writers' Voices. We always close with a quote, and I picked a quote from Charles Schulz, who, of course, as you know, was the author of Peanuts. All you need is love, but a little chocolate now and then doesn't hurt.
I'm with him completely on that one. Thank you so much for inviting me, Monica.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.